Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
I mean, some nights I could not believe Jay is on table two, Leo's on three, and Brittany's on four. And you just, there were no last names because there was no need.
This week, our guest is Chef Alex Guarnaschelli. Food television junkies know Alex from her appearances as a judge on Chopped and her many battles on Iron Chef. And serious eaters in New York flock to the two locations of her restaurant, Butter, two of my favorite restaurants in Manhattan. I first met Alex way back when she was the chef at her New York steakhouse, Nick and Steph's.
Oh, God.
In Madison Square Garden, when my friend and I, Jeffrey Steingarten, had her cook steak that was everything from fresh to 120 days aged. Ah, yes, remember that, Alex?
How could I forget?
And as you know from her television work, Alex is always dead serious and terribly inarticulate, but we've invited her anyway. Welcome to Special Sauce, Alex Guarnaschelli.
Thank you. Yes, inarticulate. I love that. I do remember aging that steak. Jeffrey and you said we want a steak to just go and go and go, and I had this special little corner for the two of you in the dry aging room, and we just ate, you know, beef that tasted like various iterations of old carpet. Which was really good.
There was some delicious old carpet all the way till about, what, 80 days?
It went too far because we used both a strip, the 179, like the bone-in strip loin, but we also did just the filet, still encased in some of its fat, which I think was a bit on,
yes,
on the revenant side of gamey. Yes,
it was definitely on the wild hair side of steak.
Yeah.
All right, so tell us about life at the Guarnaschelli family table, which I presume was atypical, to say the least, given what your mom does.
You know, it's funny. No one ever has asked me that exact question, truly. It was an unusual table, very unusual. I think, you know, a lot of chefs mine in their childhood and in their heritage for finding their culinary identity as adults. I think that's almost a rite of passage, whether you end up there or not. That's how you go through it. So for me, that would actually be very confusing because my father and mother are both still and were avid cooks.
Right.
My mother is a cookbook editor. She's an editor of all books, but mostly cookbooks. And so she has to process a book to the nth degree, which means that she has to cook her way through it. And guess who ate all that? Field
and
work.
Your mom has published some of the great cookbooks, including cookbooks from the Serious Eats crew,
fantastic,
Kenji and Stella. She's going to publish Stella's book. So you,
can't wait.
So she cooked her way through those cookbooks, and you were the kid eating what she cooked.
Yeah, and so you sort of, you know, when you're 7, 8, 9, 10, 13, 15, and you say, what's the food of my culture or my childhood? I mean, that would have to span from a whole year of Indian food, a year of the food of Emilia Romagna, a year of Mexican food from Rick Bayless, Lynn Rosetto Casper, a year of cakes from Rose Levy Birnbaum's The Cake Bible. Let's remember that Rose also did the Pie Bible. I mean, I wasn't fitting into my prom dress anytime soon. And then and then sort of as another side of the coin, my father cooked a lot as a sort of side hobby. And my father really cooked a lot of Italian peasant dishes, which were from his childhood. My father's family is from Naples. And so there was a thread of that was fairly consistent. And then also he cooked Chinese food.
Because someone should.
Yeah, I mean, what else are you doing? But I'm talking, there was always a wok hanging around, and my dad had his own special closet of stuff that no one was allowed to touch, with 70 kinds of soy sauces and dried mushrooms. And so I could easily go within a 2-week period from a samosa to a dal to a Cantonese.
And you just had a roll with it.
Yeah, I mean, well, right. I mean, cry me a river, right? Oh, boo-hoo. But it was confusing because, and maybe it wouldn't have had such an impact had I not chosen to be a chef.
Right.
On the one hand, you say, how does one become anything else? But then on the other hand, you might say, why
right,
would you actually choose,
yes,
that?
Yes, because there's two ways you can go, right? Like my son, when he was 6, we were going up the escalator at Barnes & Noble, and I said, what do you want to be when you grow up? I said, maybe you'll be a writer like your dad. And he looked at me and he goes, that's you. It was like at six,
a divide.
He was differentiating. And we're incredibly close. But so you could have gone the other way.
Well, wait, now, the other thing that you're bringing out in me that I've never actually shared is that my mother is an extremely competitive person.
Yes, I know that. I know that about your mom.
So I think, you know, that accidentally these two parallel streets, my mom's work in cookbooks and my work in cooking, they tend to touch here and there. And I just...
in
more
than a few points.
Yeah, I take a side street when that happens. Oh, Mom, how funny meeting you here. I'll be over here. Because I really don't want any of that. And she'll say, where are you going? What are you doing?
And you've managed to do that because you're Alex Guarnaschelli and she's Maria Guarnaschelli.
Totally.
And that's not so easy to do.
No. My mother is a really good cook, but she intellectualizes cooking. And there's nothing wrong with that. I wonder if that didn't push me in a more cooking as manual labor.
Like a visceral direction.
Yeah, but right. That's a better way to say it. So I think I watched her meticulously read from books and follow to the letter the recipe. And I mean, if the book told her to get in the oven with the food and sit there, she would have followed the written word. And I am much more, you know, if you cook 70,000 chicken breasts, you have an epiphany. And it comes from just staring at it, smelling at it, watching it change. And then,
you fell in love with the idea of cooking. You went to Bard.
Yep.
You cooked for a little while in the States.
Yeah.
But your formative cooking training was a very old-fashioned French apprenticeship for 7 years. What kind of human being does that these days?
Someone who's not okay. Generally, I highly unrecommend it. You romanticize. You know, you romanticize your 20s. You just do. You say, oh, it was not that bad. And it really wasn't. By the way, self-imposed. So what can you say? But let's talk about, for a brief second, my father, whose life works, but is history and Napoleonic warfare. So there was a bust of Napoleon on the dinner table. There was the poster of Napoleon on the wall.
You mean, so instead of Elijah, you had Napoleon?
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's right. There was Julia Child on TV and a bust of Napoleon on the table. So the messaging was crystal. We're Italian, but everything is about France.
That's hilarious.
And so my father would do the Napoleonic, you know, the hand and the lapel, the whole nine. So I think I just, when it came time to start cooking, I thought, well, your seminal experience in food, no matter whether you make sushi or yakitori, whatever you're going to end up doing, it has to start with a souffle. And so I applied to a work-study program at La Varenne. I went there for 9 months. I got through dish doing and a lot of Pinot Noir drinking and cheese eating. I got a diploma, a grand diplôme. And then I... Patricia Wells, the food writer.
Food writer who in part inspired me to do New York Eats because I love The Food Lover's Guide to Paris.
So good.
Because it was all about non-restaurant food.
She really, my mother knew her and worked with her on a book. And Patricia said, you know, I could probably get you like a 2-day little stage at Guy Savoy in Paris.
Guy Savoy is one of the great French chefs of the 20th century.
And the bomb.
Yeah.
And so I went for 2 days, and I had a plane ticket booked to go home after that because I had no money, and what was I going to do? And he wasn't there the first day I worked there. And then the second day he showed up, and he said, my kitchen is your kitchen. And there were 27 very grumpy, slightly malnourished
guys.
We're going to talk about that another day.
Right.
How hungry people in restaurants are. So ironic. Talk about serious eats.
Right.
And I don't know. I just, something happened. I looked at him. He looked at me. There was like a chemical. It wasn't romantic. It wasn't inappropriate. It wasn't any of those things. It was just sort of like, hey, I'd never seen a girl before.
Right.
And
First of all, let's talk about that for a second. Like,
sure.
There were not a lot of women in French kitchens then.
No, and I mean, probably there still aren't that many. I don't know. I like being somewhere where there isn't a lot of what I am, whatever that is.
Right.
I think if you're the black sheep from the get-go, then you get more attention. Oh, you know, squeaky wheels get the most oil. So, yeah,
You're comfortable being a fish out of water.
Yeah, totally. And interestingly, I always mention that the first day I got there, I was at the base of the staircase. to go up to the kitchen, and I was carrying a case of artichokes or something, and one of the cooks said, gee, you know, I have to think about what's worse, that you're a girl or that you're American. I have to really think about that. And he was serious, you know, as if
right.
he was going to mull it over, like, and get back to me.
Yeah, it wasn't, there was no irony there.
No, and no hostility. A genuine sort of, hey, wow, you really, how'd you
right.
do it?
Which way do you suck?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. And I worked my way back from that. I mean, I think it's like maybe a Bill Clinton comeback kid syndrome. I thought, boy, I'm under the underdog here. And so I didn't speak French terribly well. I didn't have a command of cooking whatsoever. And I made no pretense.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, but 7 years, you had what you had is what a lot of young cooks and chefs don't have. You must have had some patience and some desire to really master a craft.
I had to. And I think I was learning a language. I was learning a culture. I was immersing myself. So that took more time than just cooking the chicken or understanding about blanching vegetables. It takes time to learn discipline. So you have to start with patience. And then I think then you teach yourself discipline, and you get very little yield for all of this good behavior for a long time. And I highly recommend that,
mm-hmm.
particularly in my field.
Sure. So what came next after all that, after the patience and
yeah.
the low yield? And
good question. I'm still asking myself. So I came home and I thought, well, I'm just I'm the chef of the universe. I am.
Right. I
Jesus.
Survived 7 years of Guy Savoy.
Yeah. I mean, I'm Kanye West with pea pods and white beans. So, yeah. So we know where this started. So I didn't launch a sneaker brand or ask Mark Zuckerberg for $50 million, but I did immediately realize how addicted I had really become to France, its culture, speaking French. And I thought, well, a good way to get back into America slowly is to get a job in a French restaurant. So I got home on a Friday. And I think by the following Tuesday, I was working in the kitchen at Daniel Boulou's eponymous
wow.
restaurant. I think
original location.
Yeah, on 76.
Yeah.
In the Surrey where Cafe Boulou is now.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, exactly.
And I thought, well, this is going to be a cakewalk. I mean, I had been in sort of the International Olympics, and now I was kind of going to some farm team to play baseball was what I thought.
And it turned out you couldn't hit a curve.
Yeah, no, I couldn't. I couldn't transfer a lot of my skills. And then I think we come to a really important why here. And I think it's really that confidence is a really hard thing to sort out. And is it that simple as saying, I think I can, and embodying that? Yeah, I think so. I'm going to say, yeah, it's that dumb, and it's that hard. So
yeah.
It took me a really long time to sort of, sorry to say this, but to grant myself permission to think I could do it and own it.
I totally get it. And did you work under my friend Alex Lee?
I did. He was
the greatest.
At the time the best.
The greatest human being, and he's back in the game.
Yeah, he's unbelievable.
Yeah, he's awesome.
And he is so scary.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean,
Alex
to this
Lee,
day,
we should say, was the chef de cuisine at Daniel for 10 or 11 years and also did a lot of similar training to what Alex did,
yes.
working for Alain Ducasse and Monte Carlo. And he's just this amazing chef's chef. And he's thought of, if you talk to chefs like Alex, incredibly talented chefs, they will tell you how influential Alex Lee was on their careers.
Actually, a side note, the one and only time I went into the dining room at Guy Savoy all those years was when the waiter came back and said, there's an American in the dining room who loves the food. And I told him you work here and that you're American and he wants to give you his card. I went out in the dining room, I mean, as if, you know, like someone coming up from the dungeon into the light, and it was Alex Lee.
That's fascinating.
And he said, I love the food here. When you're done and you come back to America, you're going to work with me. And he gave me his card.
Wow.
I carried that card for 4 years until I came home. Actually, I forgot that until you reminded me. That's really why I wound up there.
That's fascinating. And then Alex retreated to a country club chef job
Good
because
stuff.
I think the stress just got to him. And now he's finally back in the game working in New York. So it's really exciting for all of us. So you made your rep as an executive chef really at Butter. I mean, you were at Nick and Steph's. But Butter, what's fascinating to me about you and Butter is that...
It makes no sense.
Right. Is that Butter is very sceney.
Yes.
You are so...
Not sceney.
Yes. I don't know how to say that gracefully. All right, you're not sceney.
I'll say it less gracefully if you'd like.
But... And yet, you were able to establish your rep there, which I think must have been really difficult.
Well, we get back to that comeback, underdog. I mean, Butter was really, it was a disco ball.
Right, it was a club that served food.
I was teaching at the Institute of Culinary Education at the time, and I was also working as a private chef for a family. That was sort of a little hiatus I took. And one of my fellow teachers at the school said, they're looking for an executive chef at Butter. My boyfriend's the GM. Go down there. I went down there. It was like a disco. I mean, the guy was like, hey, what's up? What can I get you? And I thought, oh, no. Are you kidding me? I poached frog legs for the president of France. I ain't got time for this. But I went in the kitchen, and I saw the staff, and there was no chef. And I thought, you know, what's this all been about? We had a nightclub, and we had downstairs, and we had a DJ booth downstairs, and we had every celebrity imaginable. I mean, some nights I could not believe. I mean, you know, things like Jay is on table 2, Leo's on 3, and Britney's on 4. And you just, there were no last names because there was no need. It was so absurd to me. You know, here I was, you know, I was poaching skate in a court bouillon, you know, and thinking this makes no sense. But let me tell you something about that odd pairing of two nightlife kids, Richie and Scott, and me.
The owners of Butter.
Yeah, it sort of worked in this odd way because, again, we didn't conflict. Talent-wise, I learned so much from them about people and restaurants and what matters and what doesn't. And I learned to give and bend a little bit. I learned how to, you know, I went to the green market. I bought whatever I wanted. No one ever told me what to cook or buy or make. And if someone said anything, I'd say it was for Beyonce. I had to do it. Why did you buy $3,000 worth of caviar? Oh, but don't you remember Busta Rhymes and Jay-Z were having that party? Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, cool. Cosign.
So that gave you cover for buying virtually anything.
Oh, you name it. I've bought it and eaten it and served it. So and then Butter just kind of accidentally continued and grew up. And now we don't have a nightclub. And now we don't have a disco ball.
And it's a restaurant that's endured.
I know. I think this will be, maybe 14 or 15
And restaurant years are like internet years. They're like dog years. So it's really
right.
14 times 7. So really you've been open for 98 years.
I mean, and it shows.
Yeah.
in my demeanor. But yeah, I think it's kind of, it's kind of neat.
Yeah.
I'm very proud of it. The staff is tremendous. The loyalty is tremendous. I've had over 20 staff members for 15 years. We just are a family. I know it sounds hokey. You've heard it before. I cooked with my grandmother as a child, and now I work in a restaurant that's all about family. We hear these cliches. Guess what? That cliche of a restaurant as a family, I embody that.
Yeah.
And I'm
down with
it.
That's so interesting. And that's how, even though Butter was very sceney, the fact that you've endured, is it because your food has evolved, or is it because you learned from Richie and his partner how to manage audiences, essentially?
All of the above. Would have to give credit to everything. I think it's so important to understand that if it were just about making good food and just about slapping a staff in the front and slapping a staff in the back, we would, you know, that just isn't what it's, in my opinion, that's just not in New York. It's too competitive. And so, I would say it was a mixture of all those things. And I mean, Richie and Scott would say, wow, that really works. Or we didn't think of that. And I would say, I would have never thought. So we fought, by the way. Don't kid yourself. But we also grew.
I know you well enough to know that.
Yeah, yeah. I dug my heels in on the funny, like odd little things. I just said, you know what? That's too far. You know, the woman dropping from the ceiling in a bathing suit while people are eating my celery root soup is just too much to bear. Can we have them later on? I'm not kidding. And then there were some really cool things, like Prince came really late one night to eat. I mean, I'm talking 4 a.m. I waited for him all night, and I cooked all these Green Market vegetables. And again, the cooking that I did for him came from my years at Guy Savoy and Danielle. Mm-hmm. And he made it a tradition. Every time he was in New York, he would come, and I would cook for him, and I would go out, and we would sit and talk about food and music. That relationship with him was, I think, almost 10 years I did that. He would call and say, she needs to be there.
That's insane.
He would call me on the phone and say, do you have any squash blossoms? Because those were so good. And, you know, how does that come about? And he said to me, you know, you're an artist. You're part of the new power generation. I mean, I don't know how many chefs get to say that Prince said you're an NPG, but I'm all about that.
By the way, that's all there is. What else can you, what club could you be a member of that's more exclusive than that?
I'm never going to get a Michelin star. But I'm new power generation. Yeah. I'm good with that.
That's funny.
I've made my peace.
So how did you get, like, I remember interviewing you for a video we did on Serious Eats about Rick Bishop, and you were funny and smart and, you know, it was so great. It was about, like, I taste the soil when I taste the food that Rick grows. So how did you make your way to TV?
You know, I just really wanted to be on the show Iron Chef America. I really didn't care about anything else. And, you know, I always say this. Some people want to embody the Dalai Lama. Some people want to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. I watched that show and I just said, I just want to be an Iron Chef.
The original Japanese one or the American
one.
Got it.
Okay. I've seen the Japanese, many of those, and those are incredible.
Yeah.
But I liked that discipline, that diligence, that perseverance, that grit. I'm like a moth to a porch light for that feeling. And so it took me almost 2 years of lobbying and begging and pleading and other such said things. But I wound up a challenger on Iron Chef America. And I thought, you know, I can be charming and funny and fun and pithy and turn this into something or try. Or I can just be a psycho and put my head down and really win. And then what do you get? And I didn't know which to choose on that very day. I rolled the dice and I thought, go with distracted, flirty, whatever else, but cook good enough food that you get respect.
That you're not embarrassed.
Yeah, so I cooked really good food. I lost, which still pisses me off. And
that competitive thing that you and your mom have.
Beyond.
All right. Okay.
But then the Food Network said, come in and let's watch you cook in a room and let's film it and explore. And so whether by accident or luck or whatever you want to call it, I ended up sort of letting that one thing snowball into more. And I wound up with a cooking show, The Cooking Loft. And then after that, Alex's Day Off, which Bobby Flay produced. And I do have to mention meeting Bobby Flay. What a strange sort of roundabout accidental mentor he has become
to me. A lot of people don't really understand that Bobby's a very complicated person.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, he's always been that way with me, by the way, too. He's been very, very complimentary and has reached out. And he does that to more people than he gets credit for doing.
Well, I think that's by design.
Yes.
I think he loves, I call him the Pope.
Right.
He's sort of this underground, you know,
right.
People say to me, like, I don't know what to do.
He loves to be the bristling bad boy in certain situations. But
he is.
And so that's sort of at odds with being the Pope.
Totally. But, you know, a lot of chefs say, I don't know what, you know, I'm at a crossroads here. And I just say, I mean, you got to do it. You got to hit the bat phone. So you call Bobby and you go to his office and you go in there and you say, you know, oh, Lord of everything, what do I do? And so let me say, I've washed up at the door of that office more times than I care to admit. And he always opens the door. And that's helpful. You need that.
Yeah.
But it's weird. I mean, he's a man. You think I would gravitate towards maybe a female mentor. We're not that different in age.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you sort of think of like Luke Skywalker and Obi-Wan Kenobi. You know, like there needs to be this big age divide. Bobby cooks Southwestern food steeped in America. I'm all France all the time. I mean, it's sort of like an odd thing. Oh, my God, beyond.
That's so interesting.
Beyond.
So you're a mom.
Oh, yeah.
You're a working chef with two restaurants, And you're on TV regularly on Chopped and various other things.
Mm-hmm.
How are you still sane?
I think there's an implication that that's never been the case. And I don't think that's a secret. So I'll just put that out there. Thanks. Thanks for the little, the cute disclaimer. I would say being a parent is brutally hard. And I don't care what anybody says about that. You know, I have a friend who, by the way, is mother to two and doesn't work. And some days I turn around and I say, you definitely had a harder day than I did. So, and I love it. I love being a parent. I am super enthusiastic. I have a 9-year-old daughter who's like my personal ice cream cone.
Yes. That's what I just... I felt that way about my son, and I still feel that way, and he's 29.
Yeah, I mean, I...
Maybe he's graduated to Hot Fudge Sunday.
I like that. I have to sniff my daughter's head to be okay. So I need that nose bath. Just this, the big nose bath with my daughter is number one. Having a restaurant that runs itself, I mean, I'm at the point where I go in and they're like, okay, thanks.
Right,
thanks
right.
Thanks for playing.
Right.
So I enjoy, I enjoy that. I think if you want to be a good chef and you want to be a good parent and you want to be all these things and you want to evolve, you have to be able to let people grow with you and let go of them and watch them outgrow you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big, I'm a big fan of that. And by the way, that struggle is real. I mean, that takes a few vodka sodas to get past.
Right. And I assume there's a lot of dark days and hours.
Total. I'm not going to. Yeah. I mean, I don't know who's having a good time all the time, but I am not. And I'm good with that. But when I need to calm down, Ed, I go to the Green Market. And I know, right? Another chef cliche. I go to the Green Market with a basket and a taffeta gown and I buy turnips. But I really think there's something very odd about the air there. And this concept of taking a look at farmers and saying they definitely have it harder than even chefs do.
It's totally true. And I, you know, when I did that Green Market video, we spent an entire day with Rick. It was 24 hours in the life of a Green Market farmer. So we went up to the farm.
Catskills.
We packed the truck.
Oh, yeah.
We got 3 hours of sleep. We left at 5 o'clock in the morning. And then I was with him all day. And that's where you and I first—you were first on camera.
Oh, yeah.
And so I always tell people, because they always complain, that's a $5 tomato. It's like, okay, do you know how much that farmer clears at the end of the year from selling you $5 tomatoes?
Yeah, by the way—
Not even minimum wage.
Some people should pay 50.
Right.
I think there should be a sliding scale of how obnoxious you are and that farmers should charge more. Yeah. If you are. Yeah, Rick in particular.
Mountain Sweet Berry Farm, we should say Rick Bishop is a seminal Green Market farmer in New York.
Unbelievable.
Developed day-neutral strawberries so we could get beautiful strawberries from, what, May to October?
Totally.
And he's a Cornell Ag School guy. He's, you know, he really knows what he's doing.
He really does, and he energizes himself. He charges his battery off of chefs and what they take the product and do with it and how they treat it and how they honor it. And, I mean, he's got so much energy. It's unbelievable. But, yeah, Rick Bishop, I think he's incredible. I think Alex Paffenroth, who, by the way, Paffenroth Gardens in Warwick, New York, he is 70.
No, Alex I know. These guys are incredible. And nobody has really told those stories
in
detail. So now it's time for the Special Sauce All-You-Can-Answer Buffet. We don't have a clock or anything like that.
Uh-oh.
But, and, you know, but you can pretend you're listening to the Jeopardy theme song.
Okay.
You know. First, what's in your Desert Island fridge?
Lemons, capers, mustard, a giant pork roast, a couple of bottles of super dry champagne, a bottle of Aperol, a few oranges, and a giant loaf of poilane bread.
Oh, man. I have to be there. All right. So that's awesome. Who's at your last supper? No family allowed. The family, because I know you'd always say your daughter and your mom and all that.
No, of course. My grandmother's.
Yeah. And it can be the last supper can be people you know or don't know. They can be living or dead. People you've always imagined would be great to have dinner with.
I'm going to go with Edith Piaf, the great French songbird, Maya Angelou, the great poet and writer,
Prince?
Prince, most definitely. He was so much fun and so is still missed. Maybe like somebody from an 80s heavy metal band like Brett Michaels from Poison.
Wait a minute. Brett Michaels, Maya Angelou, Edith Piaf, and Prince.
I like musicians, clearly.
That's great.
Maybe like we would need somebody like Diane Lucas. I know we talk a lot about Julia Child, but the great food writer, Diane Lucas.
Right, who was sort of really was the true first woman with a cooking show.
Yeah. Yeah. Her book, The Gourmet Cooking School Cookbook, is out of print and 70 years old, and I still read it like the Bible. And maybe Liev Schreiber from Ray Donovan.
All right, this is awesome.
We need
and
a murderer.
So you have to get an extra chair for me.
Yes.
All right. So what are you eating?
What are we eating at the Last Supper?
Yeah.
Well, my first answer off the cuff is everything and anything chewed very slowly because it's going to be our last meal. We want to drag it out. But I would say probably we would have, we would start with a vichyssoise with some caviar on toast because I don't think there's much better than that. And then whole roast chickens with potatoes that were cooked in the drippings of the chickens. And then maybe like a little, true Normand, like a little something refreshing, like just some lemon sherbet. And then just a chocolate layer cake so high that it looks like it might fall over with caramel on top, which is a Dobusch torte.
Right.
And then, I don't know, a lot of champagne.
That sounds good. And are you cooking? Are you happy cooking?
I have to cook everything. And set the table, and then I can eat.
Okay, that's good. So what's your guilty pleasure that's we could imagine that you turn to?
So does that mean junk food? Let's be crystal clear here.
It could, but it is not meant to be exclusively junk food.
Okay. I'll start with the first chef I really worked for was Larry Forgione, and he used to sit in his office and eat Ritz crackers with peanut butter on them in his office. And I just
one of the
thought,
greatest things in the world.
You know, he was out here cooking venison with dried blueberries, and he was in his office eating Ritz crackers and peanut butter. And I thought, well, that's not very chef-y.
And now they make them already pre-made.
No,
it's not the same.
No, you got to spread your own peanut butter. You need elbow grease if you want a really good thing.
Okay.
But I just thought that the divide between what he cooked and what he ate was large. And now, all these years later, I understand it. So I really love Oreos. And I don't like Oreos with all that crap. I don't want
and
birthday cake.
Double cream
cake.
Is just all wrong.
Yeah, I don't. I'll stack two regular Oreos. That's my double stuff, is a double stack of the single.
Yes. Now, that makes perfect sense to me. But the double stuff is all wrong because it's all about ratio and balance.
Yeah, it's just don't try to too much of a good thing it for me.
Yeah.
Okay, you guys are wrong in there. Whoever's in there in that lab is just, I don't know. So there would be that. I really love Cool Ranch Doritos. I mean, I really have a problem. And I like them. I like any chip or doodle or anything where there's a ton of sort of chemical residue that I have to lick and chew off my fingers.
You love those colors that are not found in nature from Cheetos.
Totally down. But by the way, only a fried Cheeto, not those baked ones.
Yeah,
just
yeah, that's,
stop it.
Yeah, that's just wrong. That's just wrong.
And then I love a lot of foods that are healthfully made but turn into dessert. I love a good creme caramel. I love chocolate mousse.
You love pot de creme, I bet.
I do. I like vanilla mixed with chocolate. I think that people don't realize vanilla was originally made to flavor chocolate. I don't think we remember that.
Right.
So I love the thread of a vanilla bean in a dark chocolate anything.
Got it. What do you cook when there's next to nothing in the house to eat?
That's tough. I mean, it's funny because my mom, when I was a kid, I'd say, "What are we eating?" And she would say, "How about a tuna salad sandwich?" And I'd say, "No." And she would suggest three other things. I'd say, "No." And then she'd say, "How about a tuna salad sandwich?" So it went always back to the same thing.
That says so much about you and your mother.
Yeah, yeah. Just persevere until it becomes a yes. Just keep cycling that luggage around until people believe it's their bag on the thing. So so it's always tuna salad. There's always somehow a sort of misanthropic head of celery in my fridge. Just, it ends up there, all those the little yellow stalks in the middle that are so underrated. So I chop that up with, there's always mustard, there's always capers and white wine vinegar in my world. So I mix those with some mayonnaise and tuna. And my daughter says, oh, God, this again. And I just think, you know, when you grow up, you know, you're going to really, you're going to do the same thing. All the unsexy stuff my mom did, I totally do the same.
Yep. So you have a chance to have a one-on-one lunch, a leisurely one-on-one lunch with any human being living or dead. Who would that be?
Well, I think, you know, the thing is, I'm definitely, the problem is the artists and people that you want to pick, they're probably not the friendliest. So you think you're going to sit down and get the warmth, like, hey, I'm dying to have lunch and share everything with you. So I'm going to ignore the fact that...
Yes, exactly. That they may be misanthroped.
Yeah, and I know my answer may be a little... I'm going to have to pick... I wrote my college thesis on Vincent van Gogh, and I'm going to have to say that that would be my pick. First of all, I think he was hangry. I think he didn't get enough food. I don't think he got his snack on. I'm serious. And I think it comes out in the paintings. Starry Night, my ass. I think he was really, it should have been Starving Night. And I think I would really like to cook him an excessive lunch and just sit down and talk to him about something that I think correlates between painting and cooking, which is learning all the rules so you can then break them.
Yeah.
And I think that I hope that never gets lost in cooking. The patience and perseverance of learning the basics and fundamentals up and down and sideways and then making whatever the hell you want is the way I think you become a great chef.
Yeah.
And I think that's true of his painting.
Yeah, yeah. So and then because like painting is like cooking and like any art form or craft. It's like you have to know everything to know what you can skip.
I think so.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any express bus through that.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Alex Guarnaschelli, for sharing your special sauce with us. This has been awesome.
Oh, what questions?
You can watch Alex judge on Chopped. You can eat her terrific food at the Two Butter locations in Manhattan and get yourself a copy of her cookbook, Old School Comfort Food, The Way I Learned to Cook. Alex, a pleasure.
Thank you.
So long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.